It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why neighboring Minnesota is planning to ban a chemical found in antibacterial soaps and cosmetics.
First, we're continuing our series that looks at elder care in Wisconsin. There are around 30,000 people in Wisconsin nursing homes, but according to census data and information from the Department of Health Services, different segments of the population use nursing homes at very different rates. In part four of WPR's Aging Wisconsin series, Rich Kramer looks at how three different groups use nursing homes.
At Azura Memory Care in Eau Claire, 20 residents with various forms of dementia gather around tables during a 40th anniversary party for Bob and Lois Scorgi. Bob has been in the nursing home for the past 10 years. Lois says he was diagnosed with dementia when he was 60.
And then it came a time when he was in the hospital a great deal, and he fell so much that I was told that he should have a home to live in instead of at home.
Scorgi says it's hard not having her husband at home, but with Bob's physical and medical needs taken care of, she can spend more time doing what he loves, like singing.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. There are 15 cars and 15
Bob is one of around 25,000 residents over 65 living in Wisconsin nursing homes, classified as having a white non-Hispanic heritage. But over the last decade, that population has fallen by 10,000 people as more families turn to assisted living facilities and home care options. Other groups, like Asian Americans, have seen numbers decline as well. In 2012, only 1% of people of Asian descent 65 years and older lived in Wisconsin nursing homes. Pa Tao is the executive director of the Eau Claire Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. She says she's not surprised by the numbers. Tao says Hmong tradition holds that elders should stay home and be cared for by their children.
It's really the youngest son. It's his responsibility to take care of the, older parents when they need, or when they're at the point where they can't take care of themselves. And he will have his own family and still have, his parents there.
But that tradition is changing. Tao says while it's still a taboo to send an elder to a nursing home, they seem to want more independence.
And so we're seeing that there is a trend there where, the older parent just want their own space and not so much to be in a big household with their kids and their grandkids.
Now, Hmong-owned home care businesses are stepping in to offer specialized medical care that children can't provide. In the Native American community, the percentages of elders living in nursing homes has been comparable to their white counterparts, though the actual number is much smaller. 2 years ago, 3.5% of Native Americans 65 and older lived in nursing homes. Ho-Chunk Nation member Ron Wilbur grew up taking care of his elders, and now his father-in-law lives with he and his family. But he says many families now are busier and working more. Luckily, he says, gaming revenues helped the Ho-Chunk create a comprehensive elder caregiver program, which offers home visits.
We've finally got the opportunity to afford for our elders. I think that's a big thing. I know our tribe, we've got our tribal aging units. They get, meals, they get nurses, doctors.
While the overall nursing home population in Wisconsin has declined in the last 10 years or so, the Department of Health Services says it's plateauing. And with close to 19% of the state over the age of 65, they expect demand for nursing home care among all ethnic groups to increase. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow at this time, we take a look at the challenges caregivers currently face and how the state is working to improve dementia care today and in the years to come.
After more than a decade of American involvement in Afghanistan, things are winding down for Americans there. Troops are preparing to leave the country. And a new round of presidential elections are also taking place. But here's a question. Do we really know what's going on in Afghanistan?
Our next guest is a journalist who spent years covering the war and says there's a shocking story that we're not hearing, that the entire conflict, he says, could have been over almost as soon as it began, but thanks to a political mandate to fight terrorism, the United States ignored an initial offer of surrender and, as a result, helped launch the United States into a decade-long war.
Joining us now to discuss this is Anand Gopal. He is a journalist and a fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the title of the book because, you know, as I took a look through the book, the title comes back throughout the book, and it's part of a proverb that you heard a lot, and the title of the book, There Are No Good Men Among the Living. And could you finish that for me, please?
Well, that's right. It's There Are No Good Men Among the Living and No Bad Ones Among the Dead. It was something that was told to me by one of the Afghans that I interviewed for the book. And for him, it refers to the idea that there really are no heroes, no saviors on any side of the conflict, that Afghans feel trapped between these various sides and really don't see any one of them as delivering a better life for them.
And at the same time, it also sort of reminds us, and I think you use this phrase somewhere in the book, that there are no clean hands here, that everybody who winds up in Afghanistan in the last 10 years shares some of the blame.
Yeah, there are no clean hands, and you know, we tend to think of the war as being good guys versus bad guys, but if we actually look at the people that we've supported, they tend to have human rights records that are just as bad as the Taliban.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about how you wrote the book and how you chose to tell this story. One of the things you did, you're a reporter, you're a journalist, but you're not necessarily one of those journalists we see on the other side of the cameras, you know, in a group of other journalists. You sort of went undercover to get some of these stories and to talk to some of these people.
Well, that's right, because when I landed in the country back in 2008, I was a freelancer. I wasn't with any major news bureau, and so I was kind of on my own. I grew a beard, and I wore the local clothes, and I went out into the countryside where the war is being fought, and I spent a lot of time actually interviewing the Taliban, interviewing U.S. soldiers, interviewing warlords that the U.S. is supporting, and civilians. You know, and it was through that process that I got the stories that made this book, essentially.
So 2008, why was it at that point that you felt this was a story that needed to be told? And sort of what were your expectations going in? I imagine you expected a lot of murkiness, but what else did you expect?
Well, you know, actually, I came in expecting that it was a very straightforward war because, you know, I was living near the Twin Towers on 9/11. I had lost friends in the attacks, and so that was something that was always on my mind. And Afghanistan, to me, always seemed like the good war, the war that it made sense. You know, this is a place where they launched the attacks against the United States, so I understood why the fight was happening. But traveling through the countryside, I found that it is actually much murkier than I had thought. In fact, that the people that we were supporting perhaps aren't that much better than the people that we were fighting, and that even the very idea of who is an enemy and who is an ally is much more gray. It's not really black and white as I had thought.
Can you tell us a little bit about Afghanistan before 2001? I mean, I think we all remember Russia and what happened with that. But at that time, it was sort of somewhere in this state of not really being anywhere.
Well, yeah. And in fact, Afghanistan, on the eve of 2001, Afghanistan had been at war already for about 20 years or so. And so this is it was a country that was in the middle of a conflict that had its own sort of complicated local politics. We tended to ignore that fact because when we went in 2001, we acted as if this was the beginning and that, you know, it was basically a blank slate. In fact, we didn't take into account a lot of this complicated history.
And the Taliban were there then?
The Taliban were in power. They controlled about 90% of the country then.
And it's interesting, and you read about it in your book, of course, the role of the Taliban, the presence in the country. I don't know if I have morphed, but it certainly changed over time.
Well, it did. In the 1990s, the Taliban were very famously a strict, almost puritanical regime. You know, they outlawed music. There were people who would go around and check how long your beards were, and if you had a beard that was too short, they would throw you in jail. You know, they didn't allow women outside of the house. After 2001, though, many of those members of the Taliban essentially quit and tried to switch sides. And so there was an opening for a couple of years where there was no Taliban. There was really no enemy for the U.S. to fight.
And so let's talk about then what happened in Afghanistan kind of in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And one of the things you point out is that there were some pretty mixed feelings on just what to do with Osama bin Laden.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Taliban are very intensely focused on their own country. In fact, many of the Taliban I interviewed don't know much about the world outside of their own valley. You know, they had very little interest in the United States. This is very different than bin Laden, who's, you know, as his goal was to attack the United States and had sort of global aspirations. And so within the Taliban leadership, there was really a debate, you know, should we hand him over just so we can get the U.S. out of our hair and go on to, you know, continue with our business? Or, you know, will handing him over make us look like we're really weak? That was kind of the debate that was taking place.
But then, as you point out in the book, kind of going on from that, the Taliban leaders in Afghanistan tried to surrender, and that was kind of news to me. I didn't know that within months of the American invasion. What was up with that?
Well, after 2001, the Taliban, basically from the rank-and-file foot soldier all the way up to the senior leadership, had tried to surrender. They had to try to give up their weapons and switch sides. The reason they did so is not because all of a sudden they became pro-American or pro-Hamid Karzai, the president. It's because this is basically how Afghan politics has worked. This is a country that's been at war for almost two decades. You know, when the Soviets left in 1989, a lot of the Afghan communists all of a sudden switched sides and called themselves, Islamic freedom fighters. So this is something that people have done for survival, and this is what the Taliban attempted to do, is to try to surrender and join sides with the pro-American forces.
You know, one of the things I want to return to, kind of how you wrote this book, because hearing you talk reminds me of the complexity of all of this. And you tell it through really three people. One is a member of the Taliban. One is a member of the Afghan government. And the third is a village housewife. Why did you choose that method?
Well, you know, the way I learned about this war and how the way that I had my preconceived notions challenged was by listening to the stories of Afghans. And when you do that, you realize that our idea of who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, why we're fighting, you know, those don't really hold when you look at it from the point of view of Afghans. So these three people that I chose, one is a Taliban fighter. So in other words, he's the person who's the enemy. One is a warlord who's basically our ally. And one is a civilian, this housewife, who's caught in between the two sides and has to sort of navigate through to find a way to survive.
We're talking with Anand Gopal about his new book, No Good Men Among the Living. He's took a look at the war with Afghanistan through the perspective of just some of the Afghans who lived through it. He also says the conflict could have been almost over as soon as it began, but the U.S. chose to forge ahead. We're talking with journalist Anand Gopal about America's involvement in Afghanistan and what the conflict there looked like to some of the Afghans who actually lived through it. His new book, the book we're discussing, is No Good Men Among the Living. Anand, before the break, we were talking a little bit about how you tell the story of what happened here through the eyes of these three particular people. And, you know, two of them, to me, were pretty obvious. The Taliban commander, the warlord, the member of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. But the third person, that village housewife, who has quite a story. I mean, she definitely starts in one place and winds up in quite another. How did you pick her out, and why did you choose to tell it through the eyes of an Afghan housewife?
Yeah, you know, I was interested in learning about and then relating the experiences of those people whom we have the least access to, and I think Afghan women fall into that category. You know, one of the reasons why this war is being fought, perhaps not the main reason, but one of the reasons is to better the lives of Afghan women. And so I was very interested in seeing how this war played out for Afghan women, but not just any woman. I was curious about what does it look like for women who are living in the areas where the war is being fought? Because the war right now in Afghanistan is really only in half the country. So it's not in the cities. It's in the deep south, in the countryside. So this woman that I follow, Hila, she's somebody who was born in Kabul but flees to the countryside during the Civil War, and then we get to follow her trajectory from there till today.
And the warlord, how did you pick him out?
You know, he's a very prominent member of the Afghan government, but he has a very interesting story because he was somebody who suffered very greatly under the Taliban. The Taliban tortured him. They even didn't allow him to pray in his jail cell. And so he was an anti-Taliban fighter, basically. And he was released from the Taliban in 2001, and he rose to wealth and power. And in many ways, he's symbolic of the sort of alliances that we've struck with people who may have their own agenda. In his case, he was very driven by revenge against the Taliban, and how we got ensnared into that agenda and ended up, in many cases, targeting the wrong people.
So let me ask you a practical question. How did you get these people to talk to you? I mean, you just showed up at their doorstep, or did this happen over a course of time?
No, this took almost 4 years. In fact, it, you know, especially for the Taliban commander and for the warlord, it was difficult to gain their trust, especially because I was going and double and triple checking their stories. You know, every time they had something to say, I would go and find somebody else who was there. There's not the tradition of Western journalism, you know, so they took this as an insult. And so it took a while to gain their trust. But, you know, it was interesting, for example, this politician, this warlord, most people go and interview him and ask him about what he thinks about current politics. But I started asking him about, you know, tell me about your life, your childhood. And, you know, he hadn't been asked that question very often. So people opened up. They relished the opportunity to be able to share their stories.
Now, as you mentioned a couple of times, this is a pretty complicated story. And I'm wondering, particularly when Americans first got there, was there a sense on the American side and the military that Afghanistan could be sort of neatly divided into the good guys and the bad guys?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this was the prevailing ethos. If you remember at the time, President Bush said, you're either with us or against us. That was the guiding principle of the war on terror. And that caused a lot of problems because the people that we decided were with us, these warlords, for example, you know, they pursued their own agenda. So, for instance, if you own a piece of land and I want your land and I can go and tell the U.S. military, you're a member of Al-Qaeda, and then you can get arrested and I can take your land. And, you know, this sort of thing was happening often, especially in the early years.
And that sort of It is played out in your book because the people we meet in your book don't fit neatly into those good or bad cat. I mean, they do emerge, actually, as people with a lot of conflicts that they're dealing with in terms of their family, their communities, their lives.
Yeah, that's right. You know, their priorities are very different than ours. And I think that's the one thing the U.S. didn't recognize when it got there. And even this warlord, for instance, on the one hand, he did things that I think were very terrible in terms of falsely accusing people of the Taliban. On the other hand, he was also himself a victim of great suffering at the hands of the Taliban. So, you know, we need to take all of this history into account, and unfortunately we didn't, and I think that's one of the main reasons why this conflict has been going on for so long.
You know, and as America is getting set to pull out their presidential elections underway in Afghanistan, do you have reason to believe, knowing what you know, having been there, that just the election of a new leader is going to bring big change to the country, or are we going to see more of the same, more confusion, more complexity?
I think we're going to see more of the same. You know, the president is in power in Kabul, in the capital, and in some cities. But if you go down to the deep south in the countryside, you have warlords, like the person that I profiled in my book. You have power brokers who have their own relationships with the U.S. forces, for example. You know, and they really are the ones who are holding sway. And so, you know, you may have a change in Kabul, in the cities, and for the urban population, that does make a difference. But for the rural population, and Afghanistan is about 80% rural, I don't think it makes as big of a difference as we tend to think.
And as somebody who spent a significant amount of time in the country and gotten to know some of the people there, how would you say that your own views have changed towards Afghanistan?
Well, you know, as I said, I came in 2008 thinking that this was a very straightforward conflict. You had a recalcitrant fundamentalist Taliban on the one side, and then you had the U.S. forces on the other side. You know, after doing this for 4 or 5 years, I've come to realize that, you know, at one point the Taliban were trying to be on the American side. At one point, the warlords that we're backing were, you know, acting against us secretly, that even the Taliban fighters that I've interviewed today, they can care very little about what happens in the world or in U.S. politics. They're more concerned about rivalries within their own village or their own valley.
And I want to kind of skip ahead to the end of the book here. I don't want to tell exactly where Hila winds up, but she winds up in a pretty powerful position from where she started. And at the end of your book, it really doesn't sound very optimistic. I mean, the very essence of it is that what they're hoping for is that the country essentially survives.
Well, that's right. Right now we have the Afghan government and the Afghan army, whom we are basically paying for, entrenched in the cities, and we have the Taliban entrenched in the villages alongside other warlords and power brokers. That's kind of been the case for the last few years, and there's no reason to believe that that situation is not going to change. So essentially, we're going to see the status quo in perpetuity.
Well, Anand, thanks so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Anand Gopal is a journalist and a fellow at the New America Foundation. We've been discussing his new book, No Good Men Among the Living: America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes.